Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The Florida panther makes a comeback thanks to the Texas connection. Biologists are experimenting with a breeding technique to bring back the Florida panther, otherwise extinct in 25 years. Also this time, putting up fences with Larry Somke. And Kent Brown asks Congress to help save American Civil War battlefields threatened by development.
Because history is the thing that gives a country the motivation to move in a thoughtful manner into its future, and where it has no respect for its past, it has a pretty dim future to me.
The Environment Show, a national production, made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Florida's panthers may be on the prowl again. The once plentiful and healthy symbol of Florida's wildlife, thought to go completely extinct within 25 years from human encroachment on the panther's habitat, as well as genetic problems caused by inbreeding, these panthers may be returning to North Florida. As Jim Ormond reports, the success involves Texas cougars.
When we think of wildlife in Florida, we often think of mighty alligators and spectacular water birds. More recently, however, public attention has shifted to the critically endangered Florida panther. Some predict that unless we make a serious effort at conservation, the majestic cat may be completely extinct in 25 years. Tom Logan is chief of wildlife research at the state's Fish and Game Commission. He explains that although many people are concerned about the Florida panther, the perceptions of others and encroachment are largely responsible for the problem.
Panther is endangered in Florida for two reasons. One is that it's a large predator and has for many, many years been persecuted just due to people's fear of the danger that they perceive associated with the animal, fear for safety of livestock, even their own safety in earlier times. But more than that, the problem that is most responsible for the panther status is just human occupation of the southeastern United States and development of the southeast to make it more hospitable for people to live and make a living in, and therefore they have changed the southeast to suit people more and panthers less, which means loss of a great deal of habitat essential to support panthers.
The habitat must be extensive and hospitable.
Individual male panthers occupy home ranges of over 200 square miles. Female occupy ranges of 70 to 80, up to 100 square miles each, and these generally do not overlap very much. These areas that are occupied by panthers have to be large enough to support many panthers in order to have a population that functions properly. They have to have the proper habitat for cover and travel, concealment, but also to support the kind of food base that panthers require.
Not only do panthers require vast territory to roam for food and shelter, scientists have discovered panthers lack genetic diversity. Scientists trace this problem to geographic isolation that may have occurred 200 years ago. The stagnation of the gene pool has allowed biological defects to become more prevalent in the panther population.
The inbreeding process manifests in lost genetic variation and therefore genetic and physiological fitness. The consequence is that as this process accelerates over many years, you have characteristics such as heart murmurs and reproductive problems beginning to occur at a much more frequent occurrence. And all these characteristics are are those that reduce the animal's fitness, its ability to survive, and its ability to reproduce. It's the extinction process.
To combat this problem, Logan and others have proposed breeding the panthers with their closest relative, the Texas cougar. Texas cougars and Florida panthers are subspecies of the species mountain lion. The mountain lion species has members throughout North America, South America, and Central America. While members of a subspecies may look differently due to regional adaptations, they are almost identical genetically and can breed fertile offspring. Logan hopes that diversifying the gene pool will reverse the trend of inbreeding and lead to healthier panthers. The proposed project in Florida will require scrupulous monitoring of each stage of the interbreeding process.
The plan that we're developing, which has got to go through a number of public review steps in order to meet National Environmental Policy Act requirements, is perhaps as early as next winter, during our winter field season with our Florida panther studies, actually release up to 6 to 8 individuals into the South Florida population. These would be females that we would select out of a population in the western United States, radio instrument those females, release them into some strategic locations within the South Florida population, and then monitor their survival, their recruitment into the population, and their reproductive history in the population. We'll know what their health is, what their genetic characteristics are as they breed in the South Florida population. We'll also be able to monitor the kittens that they produce, their survival, their genetic character, and eventually their recruitment as breeders in the population. So this will be a living way of injecting lost genetic material into that population, just as though we were injecting it with a syringe.
What do you say to a purist argument somebody might make that, well, if you do that, you're not going to have Florida panthers anymore, you're going to have some kind of hybrid?
Well, to begin with, you can't have hybrids within a species. The Florida panther is a subspecies of mountain lion, Felis concolor. So hybrid is not even a part of this subject. We're not going to be creating something that didn't formerly exist either. What we're going to be doing is working within genetics of Felis concolor and restoring genetic parts back into the Florida panther as a subspecies of mountain lion that still exists in the southeastern United States. So it's not a matter of creating something new or something different, something that didn't ever exist. It's a matter of reconstructing the Florida panther by managing this genetic material back into the population.
In addition to preservation of habitat and genetic restoration, concerned individuals are also working on strategies of reintroduction of panthers into North Florida. Cougars are also being employed in this effort to test the viability of returning panthers into areas they currently do not inhabit. The scientists hope that if the cougars can flourish in new habitats, so will panthers. If such reintroduction strategies are successful, we could, conceivably, see the panthers' population double. Increasing numbers, according to Logan, is crucial to long-term survival.
What we have seen is that when there are enough animals in a population on territories, they interrelate in such a way where they both look for into each other as well as avoid each other, that they repel and attract at the same time and maintain a nucleus population. As soon as you begin to eliminate some of those key individuals and the adjacent animal is no longer there, the integrity of those home ranges begins to break down, it seems, and the animals begin to wander.
Tom Logan, Bureau Chief of Wildlife Research for the Florida Game and Freshwater Fish Commission, and Chairman of the Technical Subcommittee for the Florida Panther Interagency Committee. He spoke to us from Tallahassee. This is Jim Ormond.
Anytime you talk fences, the Robert Frost poem comes to mind. Good fences do make good neighbors, one way or the other. The poem actually begins thus. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, has a fence that not only won't come down, it will make even better neighbors for humans as well as animals. That's what he says. Come see, he says. Go see, we will. Hey, Larry, how are you doing?
Bruce, hi, what's going on today?
Okay, what are you doing here, digging a post hole or
something?
Yeah,
well, I'm digging a little hole here because I'm just finishing up planting a living fence. I've got a little area here. I've planted about 6 or 8 mock orange bushes right on the property line between my yard and my neighbor's yard.
Why have you chosen this orange? It's a bush or a tree?
Well, it's called a mock orange bush, and I've chosen to go with this for a couple reasons. One, rather than putting up a wooden fence or a metal fence or something like that to divide the property, I wanted to put up a living fence so that I can provide habitat for birds, and the blossoms will bloom and the bees will come. So it'll help me attract wildlife and help make my yard more beautiful.
I can see the what you're working with right now is basically like a seedling or a sapling of a small tree. What will the bush look like when it finally grows?
Well, a mock orange bush is tall, about, you know, maybe 6 to 8 or 10 feet tall, depending on how rangy and lanky you let it grow. It's very bushy. It can be very dense. It gets very thick. These are just little, 2-foot-high sprouts. And actually, I'm recycling this out of my friend's yard, who's a tree surgeon. And he planted a mock orange fence a couple years ago, and now it grew so much, he was able to dig out a half a dozen of these for me. And he tells me that it's going to grow up probably about 4 or 5 feet over the next 2 or 3 years.
If we were to do this, any tips on actually planting them? If they get so big, do you have to spread them out?
Spread them out. You know, I've put these, most of these, about 4 to 5 feet apart. You could plant them a little closer. Right here, I've got an electrical, some sort of electrical fence, or what is this? An electrical...
looks like the support to the
telephone
pole.
Support for the telephone pole, right. And I want to put one here so we can kind of hide this a little bit. But the secret to planting these is to dig a hole that's slightly larger and slightly deeper than the ball, you know, where the root ball is, and dig that out, and then mix the soil that comes out of there with some compost. You want some compost or some other sort of organic matter that you can put a little bit of that back down into the hole, down at the bottom, because you want to make the soil nice and loose so that the roots have room to spread out and really dig in and take over and get this thing established. Then you just simply turn the pot upside down. The thing drops out into your hand. Just place it down into the hole. Start putting the dirt back in a little bit at a time. And then, you know, once you've got it once covered, push down on it real nice. You want to get out any air pockets, because if you leave air pockets in there and don't push it all down, mice can get in there and chew up the roots, and you can have problems. But it's really a pretty darn easy thing to do. And then I've got nice compost right here on top, and push it all down real nice.
And there you have it.
Now give it a watering. That's one of the secrets. This late summer, early August, fall planting is a real good time because you tend to get more rain. But if you decide to plant next spring or next summer, you have to water it almost every week just to make sure it gets watered. That's probably the biggest reason why things fail, that you don't water them often enough.
So in, 2-3 years, I wouldn't be able to see you standing behind this living fence.
That's right, and we'll have birds nesting in here, and birds and bees and butterflies roaming around. To me, it'll be much more aesthetic, much more environmental, and much more beautiful.
All right, Larry, get back to your living fence. You got some more planting to do.
Thanks a lot.
See you next time.
Take care.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. His living fence will separate his from his neighbor's yard in Hollowville, New York. This is Bruce Robertson. On many battlefields of the American Civil War, troops are massing for yet another conflict. However, unlike the First War, There are no armies, no cannon, no musket shot, no dusty cavalry, no bugles or fife and drum. The soldiers of today's conflict are private property owners and members of an advisory commission to save the battlefields. There are 50 sites considered crucial to the war that today face destruction from development of one sort or another. To save these sites, the commission has asked Congress to appropriate $70 million in emergency money. This is half of what the commission estimates it will cost to fix up these sites. The other half of the $140 million total would be raised by the 28 states where these battlefields are located. In addition, the commission is asking Congress for a separate investment of $2.5 million a year for 7 years, this to be used to acquire sites now in private ownership. Kent Brown, an attorney from Lexington, Kentucky, and a member of the advisory commission, says this is more than just another federal spending program.
It's a very sensitive thing, but it's something I think that every American, just like they should be interested in preserving the wetlands and the environment generally. This whole debate goes part and parcel with it because this is the quality of our life, and part of quality of life is appreciating one's history, preserving it, and protecting the grounds where that history was played out.
In Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia, where civilizations have existed for thousands of years, cathedrals and temples, 1,000 or more years old, stand in the midst of modern cities. Brown says these older civilizations seem to be comfortable with their history.
The United States, though, has from its very early days, I think, developed a mentality of go out there and get what you want, make your way. And it's that sort of mentality, I think, that that inhibits our stopping and thinking about who we are and what we are and what happened before us. We'd rather bulldoze it over, make our way, and go on to the next project. And it's somewhat unique in the American psyche. And it's the one thing I think that we need to do the most work at educating. And that is that though that is part of the American dream and a noble one, one that I applaud, nevertheless, we have got to stop and somehow reassess some of that philosophy when it comes face to face with our history. Because we are about ready to lose the history we have. And if we cannot take our children and grandchildren out to these sites, show them what happened, explain to them the numbers of losses and the types of commitments these people had, which, by the way, gave us the very rights that the private property interests want to protect here, then we will have a country with no basic direction to it. And because history is the thing that gives a country the motivation to move in a thoughtful manner into its future, and where it has no respect for its past, it has a pretty dim future to me.
The problem facing these historical sites is the same one facing wetlands, our national parks, even the open space on the outskirts of any town, your town or city, namely population expansion and development interests. Consider the situation in Franklin, Tennessee, where a battle was fought November 30th, 1864.
It was once rolling lands up to what was the Carter House and the Carter Gin House, just on the outskirts of town, up the Columbia Turnpike. And today, it is almost as far as your eye can see, a housing development. Now, this housing development is not of recent origin. This occurred in the 1950s and 60s, and when there was no great movement to protect battlefields. And right now, all you have left of the Franklin battlefield is the small Carter House and maybe 3 or 4 acres around it. And the McGavick House, which is on the fringe of the battlefield, but all of the rest of the territory over which the attacks were made and the fighting occurred, and certainly some of the most horrific fighting of the Civil War, is now completely gone. One would never be able to take a youngster out there and point where troops came from or how they fought, because it's gone.
There were some 10,000 battles or armed skirmishes fought between 1861 and 1865. Of these, nearly 400 were principal battles of the war. 45 were a turning point in the fighting, either in that particular region or for the war itself. Just these 45 represent a lot of valuable real estate today, especially as much of it is in the Virginia and Maryland region around Washington, D.C. In these areas, Brown says, a strategy developed by an association in Perryville, Kentucky, might be employed. The battlefield in Perryville received $2.5 million through the federal ICE-T, the Intermodal Surface Transportation Enhancement Act. These monies will be used to appraise and purchase key elements of the Perryville battlefield area.
We are currently now appraising 13 parcels of property with property owners. We have wooed those property owners into the fold by making virtually all of them members of the association. And we have carried on a series of meetings, public meetings with them and other citizens of the community, to explain to them exactly what we're doing, that everybody is being appraised at the same time, and that if you can, we'll do the best we can to get the best price, but there's also a segment of community service here that we're looking for from all of you, that if you truly want this kind of resource for your community, which would bring great deals of money to Perryville, then there's going to have to be some degree of sacrifice. In other words, you can't think that you can get the top dollar on it, and we have to sell them on that. It takes an enormous amount of persuasion, but it does work.
Brown says both the federal and the state's tax codes also need some reworking to make it more attractive to convey property through wills and such. The key to any acquisition and long-term protection plan is to get willing sellers. Otherwise, there will be no sale, no land protection, and nothing for future generations to experience. And, says Brown, this applies to battlefields being lost, as well as to those being loved to death, with all sorts of commercial development around. Either system represents an encroachment on the hallowed ground.
As the one park guide at Gettysburg once made the remark that he one day was going to take out a group of Boy Scouts and tell them that Pickett's division came across this field but had to withdraw to the McDonald's, only to be repulsed again at the Hardee's and then retreat all the way to the Howard Johnson. We can't have that, even though those are support-type businesses. They must be put up at a location where, on some master plan, they are useful, they can prosper, but they're not obtrusive.
With such a plan in place, we might just satisfy, to borrow from Mr. Lincoln himself, most of the people most of the time.
If a battlefield is protected and preserved, if it has that type of sensitivity in its planning, this can be, for any given community, probably the largest and cleanest moneymaker that they could ever hope for. And in sagging economies in rural areas around the country where many of these battlefields are, this can be the single greatest boon to their economy. But it's one that they've got to recognize it's going to take some civic responsibility that may require them to have to give a little. And it's also going to take a heightened awareness and a heightened sensitivity as to how you treat these fields once you get them. And if you combine all that, it is absolutely magnificent for an economy of a local community or a state.
Kent Masterson Brown, an attorney in Lexington, Kentucky, and chair of the Gettysburg National Military Park Advisory Commission. He also serves on the Civil War Sites Advisory Commission, which recently made a multi-million dollar recommendation to Congress for restoration and protection of many other key but rapidly disappearing Civil War battlefield sites. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show this week. Thanks much for joining us. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for the Environment Show, program number 189. The Environment Show, a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show, made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.